Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. A podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkor, and more importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. David Brick, who is Assistant Professor of Sanskrit Literature at the University of Michigan. We'll be speaking about a brand new OUP publication called Widows Under Hindu Law. And this publication is actually part of the Roche Indology series. And so we could talk maybe a bit about that as well. David, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks, Raj. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure indeed. This is, of course, a fascinating, rich, potentially even hot topic. Tell us a bit about how you got interested in this line of research.
Yeah, it's a good question. So, the origins go back to a paper I wrote in grad school that was nothing to do with my dissertation. But I was taking a class Cynthia Talbot, and it was on historiography in India, mostly looking at the construction of Indian history in the colonial and later periods, that sort of thing. But for my final paper for the class, she suggested I write on Sati because it was this new book, Contentious Traditions, by Lata Mani on the topic. And it wasn't, I mean, it's not super new, but less than 10 years old at the time. And I said, okay, I'll do this. And so I read it. I thought it was interesting. I still think it's interesting. But it got me thinking about classical Indian sources on the topic, because I'd already was working on Dharmashastra, on Hindu law at that period, and kind of fledgling specialization. And I thought, oh, what do they have to say about it? I didn't really know. And so I did some research and found a kind of very interesting debate on sati, or widow self-immolation, or whatever you want to call it, in Sanskrit literature. And that's what I wrote the paper on then. And eventually that became an article that I published in the Journal of the American Oriental Society, not long after graduating. And then that was kind of the beginning. And I initially had not thought of writing a book on this topic. But it's sort of enough widow-related issues became important that it sort of started to feel like it could be a book. So that's one way of answering that question. You know, it's sort of, I got into it by chance this way. The other reason I find it interesting, I think it sustained my interest, nothing to do with necessarily its origins, is I think if you want to understand the treatment of women, gender ideology in kind of classical India, classical Hinduism, widows are a really good figure to study, uniquely good, because there's clearly within the tradition a great deal of comfort with married women. So this is the norm. You say, okay, a married woman's married, easy. We have kind of rules. We understand that. That's fine. And there's going to be little disagreements about things in the tradition, but it's pretty comfortable. And little girls who would also exist would be unmarried. They're also okay because, you know, they're not yet marriageable age. And if you sort of at some point come to believe in child marriage, then marriage can be extended earlier into life. And then you have that. But with widows, you have a class of women who are of marriageable age, but they're not married. that and they can't be avoided, because you have the alternative within Buddhism and Jainism, where you have women who renounce, become monks or nuns, whatever you want to call them. But Hinduism generally doesn't allow that. But with widows, you have a class of women who are sort of outside of the controlling bonds of marriage that can't be avoided. You know, many women outlive their husbands. And so how they deal with those, I think, is a really interesting test case on conflicts within the system, how they sort of deal with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's absolutely. What sources are you looking at? What's your data for the project?
Yeah, for this project, it's all Dharmashastra texts, basically. That's the core. Because I'm interested, in tracing the treatment of widows within the Hindu legal tradition, within Dharmashastra. That's not the complete scope of what I look at, because I look at other adjacent literatures outside of the Hindu legal tradition. It's not like a strict line, like it's outside of that, I just don't look. But I would say it's much harder to do a systematic search outside of that, referencing these things. And I haven't attempted that. But I do come across, I try to read pretty broadly. So there's things outside of the Hindu legal tradition that I'll look at and come across and say, oh, that's really interesting. I want to bring that in. Some stuff earlier, the Vedic period, a lot of it just adjacent outside. So like in the book, at one point there's a Jain text that's really interesting, quite useful, because it appears that widows' inheritance rights increased at a certain point under Dharmashastra rules. But the question is, does this reflect anything within society? Does it reflect any kind of big social changes? But it happens that there are Jain texts from about the 12th century, same period, that also talk about widows' inheritance rights increasing at exactly that same period. That's interesting to me. You say, wow, this looks like something going on in the real world outside of the text.
Yeah, it's really interesting that this your work, this monograph, is really the first comprehensive look at what at everything that the Dharmashastras have to say about widowhood. And now, I'm just before I dive into the heart of that project, what else, you sort of a little tantalizing comment, what else might you perhaps look at, or might one look at, beyond the Dharmashastra literature? You mentioned maybe Vedic texts. Would one at all look at epic traditions, Puranic traditions? Where else might one look?
Oh, beyond that, I mean, there's almost any place. The issue then becomes identifying your relevant passages. It's not perhaps as easy to find. Also, there's not... Dharmashastra has a decently, in my view, decently clear-cut chronology of earlier to later, so you can trace developments in a way that's not... You don't have to dispute the kind of chronology of the text too much. That is not the case with others, but I think the Puranas you could do for sure, the epics for sure, Vedic literature would be another one. Outside, you could look at Jainism. All of those are possible. Each has their own problems, and it's not the case that Dharmashastra is without, it's not a naked, transparent glimpse into social practice. So it's not, but neither are the epics. I think each has their own unique problems. I mean, in the case of the epics and things like that, you always have the fundamental problem that people do things in stories that they don't do in real life, and everybody knows that. You know, that's the issue. But same time, you have things that they do in stories that they do in real life, and how to figure that out. And maybe you're not interested in real life, you're interested in narrative. That's okay too. In the case of Dharmashastra, you have your problems because it's, I mean, they're prescriptions about how people should behave, but were they followed? To what extent were they followed? And all those are really tough questions.
Indeed. And I speak from personal interest that one is either courageous or foolish to study narrative. So I get it entirely. Tell us about the prospect of remarriage, widows remarrying. When, if at all, could widows remarry? Maybe talk a bit about your first chapter.
Yeah. I mean, widow remarriage, for the most part, seems to have been somewhat allowed in the Vedic period, to the extent we have glimpses of it. I mean, the issue with the Vedic texts is they don't talk as matter-of-factly and in kind of quite a sustained manner about these issues, so it's harder to piece together. But it appears that there was some remarriage at that period. By the period of the Dharma Shastras, so the Dharma Sutras starting maybe 3rd century BCE is what we generally say, most of our texts oppose widow remarriage, assume it's outlawed. That, of course, doesn't mean it didn't happen. I think there's evidence that it did happen. I mean, you get words like punarbhu for a remarried woman, and they have laws for what do you do with the child of a remarried woman. So I have one wife who's never been married before. I have another wife who's been married before. Do the sons from the two different women have different inheritance rights? And they do, which tells you this happened. So there was remarriage. It was prohibited for the most part within Dharmashastra literature from the get-go. The big exception are a few late texts, interestingly. Narada appears to have a somewhat permissive view of widow remarriage. And Parashara, famously Parashara, because Parashara has a verse on it. And this becomes, interestingly, in the colonial period. This is not in the book, exactly. But in the colonial period with Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, who's like the great Hindu reformer on these issues for widow remarriage, this verse of Parashara, it becomes sort of his central text in his argument for allowing widow remarriage from a kind of strictly Hindu theological point of view. He has other arguments in favor of it too. But for the most part, it's widow remarriage sort of is falling out of vogue, even by the beginning of the tradition. And it's always a minority voice that allows widow remarriage. And by the period of the commentaries, that's completely gone.
Widows inherit.
And then it reemerges in the colonial period.
Are widows allowed to inherit? And if so, under what conditions?
Yeah, right. And this varies. This is one of the big, I think, discoveries of the book, is that widow inheritance rights increase enormously over time. I mean, so that, again, we're talking largely about the Dharmashastra tradition, but even if you go back to the Vedic period, there are something from the Taittiriya Samhita that would lead you to think widows, women, could not inherit property at that period. And come to the early Dharmashastra literature, it's more or less in keeping with that. Widows' rights of inheritance are pretty negligible. Now, I say that not to make things too complicated. There is a class of wealth called Stridana, women's wealth, which women inherited. And it was inherited kind of matrilineally from mother to daughter and so on and different. But that was in kind of the grand scheme of things for a moderately well-to-do family, pretty insubstantial amount of wealth. So it would consist largely of movable property, jewelry, and stuff. Whereas the big items of wealth would have been land by this period. And women did not inherit their husband's property early on under any circumstance, pretty much. Then that changes with Narada. Not Narada, Yajnavalkya. And we generally date him about the 5th century or so of the Common Era at this point. And suddenly, he won't say Narada, Yajnavalkya, changes it. And he says, if a man dies without sons, his first heir is his wife. So his widow inherits his property, providing there are no sons. Whereas before, it would have gone anywhere patrilineally, but not to the women. And that changes with Yajnavalkya. He sort of inaugurates this move to make widows the primary heirs to a man if he dies without sons. There's a big intense period of debate about this. Some are in favor of it, some are opposed to it within the Hindu legal tradition. And then it's really about the 12th century, maybe tail end of the 11th century, that the kind of matter becomes settled. And it's in favor of widows' rights of inheritance. So widows are allowed to inherit their husband's property with some minor qualifications, if providing there's no sons involved.
So yeah. In what it sounds like to be the majority of the situations, at least within the texts where the widow does not have a right to inherit. So individual householder passes away and the property and resources go elsewhere to the sons, etc. So what happens with the widow in that circumstance? So paint a picture. It's supposed, what happens to her?
It's supposed to be maintained in those periods. So if she has sons, her sons are supposed to take care of her, like their aging mother. In an ideal world, she would be old by this point, by the time she's widowed, but maybe not. But the sons would take care of her. And if she didn't have sons, in the kind of pre-widow inheritance view, whoever inherited the husband's property, whatever man did, was supposed to maintain his wives, provide for their maintenance. And some texts even get kind of specific about, this is all in the commentaries, about what precisely constitutes maintenance. So they do. So it would normally be, say, if you didn't have a son in the old system, the early one, my brothers would inherit my property, not my sons. If I didn't have sons, not my wife, my brothers, I mean, they would take care of. And if I don't have brothers, maybe my brother's sons. So it would go basically the same way as Shraddha writes, if you think about it this way, with the patrilineal system strictly. And so property devolved exactly that way. Whereas that changes at a point. And then I guess the obligation to support widows once they're able to inherit disappears because they have property. But then there becomes limits on usage. So that's a whole different thing.
You mentioned in passing that one of the discoveries of the book is, you know, the situations where widows could inherit, et cetera. Is that what you found most surprising? What most struck you about this process and your findings?
Yeah, that was one, that this that widows' inheritance rights increased. Though this was noted in a fashion by Olthakar a long time ago. He has, what's the title of his book? Women in Ancient India, maybe, is what it's called. Anyways, it's something, but A.S. Olthakar noted this. His issue, so he kind of noted the outline. In his work on this, the problem from my perspective, though it's quite good, he was fundamentally right. His chronology of texts was a little different. So he still placed the Vishnu Dharma Sutra way earlier, whereas now I think it's pretty convincingly been placed in the 7th century. And then everything fits because it does allow widows to inherit. So it's a post-Yajnavalkya text. So he had some issues there. He doesn't really talk about the commentaries that much. So I wouldn't say I was entirely surprised, having read Olthakar, that I found something similar. Probably the most unpleasant but somewhat surprising finding of the book was that Sati, or Sahagamana, as they call it in Sanskrit, appears to have become popular in Brahmanical circles shortly following widows' increasing inheritance rights. So the first text to allow widows increased inheritance rights is Yajnavalkya Smriti, or Dharmashastra, doesn't matter the terms. Right after that, we first get Sati with Vishnu, who comes just afterwards. So Sati is introduced right after widows. And then there's a debate. The Mitakshara is sort of the first text to really grant widows robust rights, first commentator, and he sort of ends he's sort of the definitive text. The Mitakshara ends the discussion, and everybody afterwards more or less concedes the point. But the Mitakshara's views on Sati are pretty ambivalent. It's kind of opposed. But afterwards, all opposition to Sati sort of disappears. And so that inheritance rights increase, and shortly followed by an increase in acceptance of Sati is a pretty grim. When you kind of map out the textual chronology and see positions, I think it's fairly inescapable.
And perhaps for our more general audience, what is this thing called Sati?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, if people that don't know.
No, I imagine most of the audience would be aware.
Yeah. So this is a practice where Hindu widows could optionally ascend their husband's funeral pyres and kill themselves by ascending the funeral pyre after the death of their husband. And this was considered a meritorious act, never required. It was always considered optional, at least within the texts. But it was considered sort of an especially meritorious option. And it would always been a minority of women who did it. It goes way back within the Indian tradition, back at least as far as some sections of the Mahabharata. Even earlier, there's a few Greek references to it. But it appears to have initially been strictly a royal phenomenon, meaning queens. Rarely, but some queens would do this. And this was quite common in lots of cultures, sort of early ones. You find this in you know, pre-colonial West Africa. You find it in China, Egypt, for kings. But then in India, at a certain point, it takes a different turn, and this sort of practice of following into death becomes potentially widespread, so that not just the wife of a king could do this, but any wife, in theory. And that's what we're able to track really with Dharmashastra, is Brahmanical customs. When did Brahmins start to do this? Because kings, they're not terribly concerned with what royal, you know, the individual royal customs. And forget about the low classes. They're not really interested in the private practices and customs of the lower classes. So what they were about is almost, is unknowable from our sources.
Maybe a bit out of your research, but I imagine there would be my purposefully naive questions typically are questions I imagine that the audience may have. So do we have a sense of the state of this practice currently in India?
Well, it's somewhat beyond my area. I mean, it was a famous example with Roop Kanwar in 87, 82, in the 80s. There's a famous example where a woman did this in Rajasthan, got a lot of publicity. Since then, I'm not sure. I mean, in a nation of 1 point some billion people, that maybe it happened somewhere, it wouldn't surprise with so many people, you know, because all kinds of things happen. But it's extremely rare. I mean, it's basically gone. It was ended for the most part with Ram Mohan Roy's reforms and his kind of challenge, I think 1819, is it, or 1817? So early 19th century, it was sort of ended in British India. It carried on as an exceptional custom in certain princely states in India. Those ended up disappearing too by the middle of the 19th century. And so it's been outlawed for over two centuries now, and is basically a gone practice. I mean, with the occasional freak occurrence. But I think the tradition, you know, I think within India, it's a complicated issue how to deal with this practice, not as something that almost no one is advocating this kind of to resuscitate this practice, but how do you deal with it? Which is, I think that's something I try to be sensitive to as a scholar to a point, but then you have to do your work. Because I don't want the book to be taken as an attempt to defame Hinduism or something, which I can understand. Because maybe say, well, this is an unsavory part of Hinduism's past that maybe people say, which would be forgotten, and don't see the point in discussing it, which I can sympathize with. I don't fully agree with it, of course, but I can. So I don't want to make. I don't want to get the impression that my attempt is to defame Hinduism in this regard. I think it's the treatment of widows is important from a historical point of view, for the reason that it's a good way to track changing gender ideologies, how they change, because married women, I think it's a much more stable concept and you'll get less shifting. Whereas widows, I think, really cause problems. What do you do with them? Remarriage, is this an option? If it's not, what do we do? All these kinds of things. And this is why they were a big issue in the colonial period. It's not entirely a fabrication. So I'm sensitive to both the attempt that I don't want to. I don't know, but that's maybe a bit not exactly what you asked. But I think that when you talk about these issues, you know, the last thing I want is anybody to, I don't want anybody to feel like they should revive these practices. Certainly not. And I don't want anybody to feel that, I have any ill will or an attempt to defame. But I would view the same way with Western practices. It's not as though, I don't know, you look at witch burning in the colonial period, and I think it's both wrong to deny it and wrong to
and problematic to celebrate it, obviously.
Yeah, to celebrate it, of course, it's problematic to celebrate it. You know, so I think it's just you've got to come to grips with certain things in the past of any people that are maybe not, you don't want those around, you wish they hadn't happened, but you have to come to grips with them. And
well, our job is to understand. You're presenting your findings in terms of the portrayal and prescriptions of widows in a particular class of text that is, you know, particularly litigious. And so our job is to understand other
that's cultures, right,
understand other epochs. We are not, in my view, it's wise to understand them on their terms and not impose whether cultural or historical, contemporary, you know, what you know, which tradition under the sun is not replete with both savory and unsavory delights for yeah, us right. to sample.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so it's a question of understanding.
I think that's first. To understand is the first goal. And to do that, you do have to try to understand the authors. For me, it's texts, the authors I read, on their terms first.
So secondly, tell us... Sorry, go on. Please.
Yeah, then secondly is other stuff. You know what I mean? First, understand the authors on their terms.
So what do we think? I understand much of this will be conjecture, but what do we, how do we understand the reception or audience? I'll ask you two questions, and the questions are always meant to be generative. There's nothing that I'm particularly looking for other than whatever comes out of your mouth, wherever that may lead. So what do we understand, or what can we infer about the audience of these texts, and do they have any bearing in our present times in terms of legal or social systems?
So the audience for the texts, I mean, now it's a much diminished audience, but the audience when they were, when Dharma Shastra was sort of a living tradition, would have been kind of an elite group of Brahmin men, almost entirely, with some elite non-Brahmins perhaps also engaging in this discourse. But it would have been pan-Indian, meaning this tradition spanned virtually the entirety of the Indian subcontinent, so people participated in it, but it would have been a very elite group, educated in scholastic Sanskrit and all of the concepts involved there. Yeah, so I think that's the key with the audience there. In terms of their impact, like how these, what did these people do with these texts? That's a tougher issue. I think with my understanding of Dharma Shastra that I kind of lay out the intro to the book, I think of it as a combination of, it's largely a scholastic tradition, I guess. That's what I should say first. But at the same time, it does have elements of practical law in there. But you have to understand that first, it's a scholastic tradition. So if you pick up a Dharma Shastra text, much of what you'll find in there is there, not because the author at that time found these to be the most pressing legal issues in his real life. Most of the contents are there because that's what the tradition talks about. And if you're writing a text in this genre, you talk about those things, whether they're relevant or not. So the example I give frequently is there's these pancha pancha nakas, the five nailed animals that you can eat. And, you know, this starts early in the Dharma Shastra tradition and carries on. But by the Middle Ages, Brahmins couldn't eat any of these animals. No one was eating any of these things. It was largely vegetarian, and certainly eating five nailed animals wasn't going to be eating a monitor lizard or a porcupine or whatever. But they would still talk about it like it was something, like it was a pressing legal issue. They would have, and you know, but this was completely, you know, so if you read that text as contemporary at that time, you'd miss, no, they're talking about this because it's a scholastic tradition. That's why you talk. So a lot of Dharma Shastra is like that, to appreciate, and they won't say that, well, this is just scholastic stuff. You have to understand the tradition to understand. And by this point, this is not. But it doesn't mean everything was like that. There'll be other things that will be pressing. So I kind of give a couple cases where I think you see things happen that indicate real change on the ground. One is when a new topic is introduced, something without precedent. So when they first introduced the five nailed animals, I assume there was some place in India where people could eat these five nailed animals. But then that just stays because that's part of the tradition. So when Vishnu introduces sati as a practice, Vishnu Dharma Sutra we're talking about, that's probably because it was something new. You know, he's not doing it because of tradition, because it wasn't there in the tradition. Why then? So that's one case, when something new comes in, that we're talking about something going on in the real world. The other one is when you have a radical change in position. So with inheritance rights, prior, women could not inherit. Then Yajnavalkya turns everything on his head, says they can. It's not pride in the man, not, doesn't have sons. Why that change? I think then because something's really going on the ground. So there's a couple cases, but you have to read them critically. Each case, is the person doing this because it's a scholastic thing, just going through the motions, or is there something else? And I think that's, and then you can see cases where, like I said, with the case of the Jainism, where you have widow's inheritance rights increasing according to Dharmashastra in about the 12th century, and you have Jain texts talking about increasing inheritance rights from a totally different, unrelated perspective at the same time. That's a good, so that tells me something's going on. And in that case, I don't want to say that the Dharmashastra, the changes in Dharmashastra is the reason for the change of inheritance law, nor is it the Jain texts as a reason for the change in inheritance law. Inheritance law is changing and it's being reflected in different textual sources. That I think is the safest route, rather than one being the cause and the other one. Instead, it's going on and we can see it in different sources. So that's one. Okay, but now the other question you had asked about was relation, kind of relevance of these texts and this today, quite diminished, of course, but not diminished to the point of complete oblivion. So Hindu law, like under the British, these Hindu legal texts, the Dharmashastra tradition, was incorporated as kind of the private law for Hindus under the British when law became codified. And then it's been changed a lot for various reasons over time. But there's still a core of Hindu law in India that traces back to the Dharmashastras that's there. And this has to deal with things like inheritance, adoption, marriage laws. So that's there. But I think the bigger legacy of Dharmashastra is in all kinds of ritual customs that people still practice today, dietary rules and these kinds of things. So people that, you know, have rules of you know, whose food you can eat. The menstruating woman doesn't cook in the home is pretty typical. So these rules, where are these kind rules like this articulated in text? The Dharmashastra texts are the texts that most clearly talk about these things. So a lot of these things you'll see in contemporary Hinduism involving purity rules and stuff are very similar to Dharmashastra rules, some cases basically the same. If not, they're certainly in that family of resemblance. When it comes to funerary rites and these, it's all very much in the Dharmashastra vein. So a lot of that, in a lot of religious customs and practices, you see this. And that's a big part of the Dharmashastra that has a legacy today, I would say.
Fascinating. You know, I think you're right in that it's the phenomenon that occasions the text and not vice versa. And to my mind, it's a common unconscious pitfall that many scholars of Indic traditions fall into because of the emphasis on text as source in Abrahamic traditions, and also the very mode of scholarship, right? We're looking through text, we're looking at text, we're learning, you know, how does one become a scholar, irrespective of when it ends up studying, one's doing ethnography, even one starts off by being rather bookish, perhaps, and, you know, looking to texts for knowledge. And so it really does seem to be the case in much of South Asian religiosity, that the text represents the condensation of something that's happening on the ground, and a condensation thereof that itself is malleable and amenable to innovation and interpretation. And so the very notion and purpose of text, as we sort of unconsciously presume based on our own experiences as Western scholars, seems so different in the Indic tradition. To my mind.
Yeah, I think what you said is right. Also, but to be fair, if you were to ask someone today, like I'm trying to think of an example, if you have Durga Puja or something, okay, you perform Durga Puja in the fall because that's when she killed Mahishasura, or did she kill Mahishasura in the fall because that's when you performed Durga Puja? right? The question is, and I would be inclined to view it the way you do, say, well, it was happening in the fall, therefore you date this, you know, there's this thing going on the ground, and therefore our texts, our narratives explain a practice rather than the practice always deriving from the narrative, say within narrative literature. And I think, but I think a lot of practitioners themselves would, of course, say the opposite. The text predates the practice. You know what I
yes,
mean?
But, so, yes, but practitioners, I think that's a great example insofar as, you know, it just so happens that my doctoral work was on the Devi Mahatmya, right? So this is the first time we see the great goddess in all of Hindudom. And certainly people didn't wake up 15 centuries ago-ish and be like, we need a divine great mother. Here we go. Yeah. Clearly, I mean, one has to surmise or deduce that her worship was so prevalent she needed a Sanskrit text. People were worshiping the great goddess. You know, this is why in chapter 12 in the Palashruti it says, you know, particularly the autumnal festival, someone would surmise the autumnal festival was happening for quite some time, which is why they had to give her a text.
And yet
you're exactly right insofar as in the modern world, particularly in India, which has, you know, a legacy of a particular education system and a colonial legacy, but also just whether someone's from Indic background or whatever background they're from in the modern world, let's go look at the book. Let's go buy a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. What does the text say? And unless you're studying in a living tradition, you don't understand that the vast majority of teachings to this day are preserved in oral memory on whether it's Yoga Sutras, whether it's Tantric texts, certainly whether it's the Bhagavad Gita, even the Devi Mahatmya, unless you've had the experience of having had, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of exposition that is meant to supplement or complement what you see in the written text. It is fascinating because you're absolutely right. I think the vast majority of Hindus would look to, you know, where can I find a copy of the Bhagavata Purana or the Markandeya Purana? What does it say in the Puranas? What does it say, quote unquote, in the Puranas? But I think many fail to understand that that is a relatively recent internalized bias.
And I think if you look at, it is, I think, I don't know how recently internalized that is, but you're right. It is a bias. And it's also common sense. You know, you'd say, someone come up with a text on making temples before temples existed? That seems unlikely. You know what I mean? It seems that people were building temples and then you come up with rules. They're not like someone imagined what temples would be like. But I guess the classic idea of Shastra presupposing a practice, which you see in certain branches, you know, has that. But that's not, that seems, you know, we don't have to believe that. That's not, that doesn't make any sense. But it's also, it's complicated. Because in the case of text.
Absolutely.
And narrative, you can't have a synergistic thing or whatever, where there's, the text reflects certain things because this is the practice, but then certain influential texts can steer practice in certain ways, which also happens. So you can get both texts being influenced by practice and practice influence. But I guess this kind of simple world, you can't have that, you know, but this kind of messy world of interaction. And especially if texts like the Puranas are written in a timeless idiom, and the Smritis are the same way. I mean, all the Dharma Shastras are. If it's all written in a timeless idiom, then you can't have a messy world of practice influencing text and text influencing practice. Though surely this was what happened, you know, in the real world. I mean, when you write in a timeless idiom, it can't be, you know, it can't be that. You know, contemporary practices in 12th century Karnataka are influencing this or that. You know. That all kind of
indeed, and I think
that's what happens in the real world, but it's not what you say.
And I think in the case of the Puranas in particular, and by virtue of the very name of the genre, ancient, you know, tales of old, that they purposefully elide historicity so as to present something as eternally true.
What do you hope
folks would take away from widows under Hindu law?
Oh, that's a good question. What are the things to take away? I suppose I view it partially as a source book. So if you have questions about any of these things, you're looking at, more famous discussions of sati in the contemporary context, or whatever issue, remarriage, that they can look to it and have a very detailed account that will give them a lot of background on these. That's sort of a comprehensive take on any widow-related issue that they might find interesting. So that's part. I think a big chunk is a source book. The other things, I suppose, would be the idea that you can use Hindu legal literature to trace changes in customs, that you really can if you look at, if you read the text carefully and critically, slowly and painstakingly, you can actually trace, now I say Hindu customs, I really mean Brahmin customs, because those are the ones we can trace, and to what extent Brahmin customs resemble the customs of non-Brahmin Hindus is, well, that's a tough one to know. Not unrelated, not completely unrelated, but neither are they the same. So that's a tough issue. But that you can at least trace how Brahmanical customs evolved with a remarkable degree of specificity. If you read the text carefully, historically, we have this long. So that's another thing. The other thing is a general problematic nature of widows. That they were from a kind of classical Brahmanical perspective. If I think, put on my mind, and I'm going to be a nice, like, Brahmanical jurist, widows were a tough class of people. You can't legislate them away, because there's no way to make it so that widows don't exist, because it's just going to happen that husbands die first, especially when the women are a lot younger, and men tend to die younger. That you're going to have a lot of that. And you have a sort of a rule against women's independence. What do you do? How do you deal with widows? You know, this is, I think, and that the tradition has struggled with that. And that's one of those generative tensions. And so you can really see a lot of movement. I think there's other areas within Hinduism where you see kind of how do they deal with this? And then it produces a lot of discussion. Like, I think incorporating celibate asceticism within the tradition. How do you do that? This is something that was not, is natural. Like Buddhism, it's at the core. In the case of Hinduism, it's not. And so but at the same time, it's part of it. So how do you incorporate it? How do you, and I think widows were a similar thing and how they do it. And then there's competing imperatives. With the case of widows, the imperative to procreate, the imperative to not have independent women, and marital fidelity becomes, so if a husband dies and you don't have sons, is it fidelity to the deceased husband or the imperative to procreate that rules? and you see different answers at different points because these are both there. So I think that's why. So I think that's why widows. So that's why they're. That's why to me they're an interesting group, because I think there's a point where you can not finally. It's one of the cases where you can really see certain kind of axiomatic beliefs of the tradition come into conflict, and they have to negotiate, have to figure out which one takes primacy. So that's why. Yeah, I guess those things. But and then the usefulness of Dharmashastra to kind of record, to provide a history of Brahmanical practice, which, it's a bit frustrating that we've stuck with only kind of elite practice, but you've got to make peace with the sources you actually have and, write the history we can write based upon the sources that actually exist, not the ones we wish existed.
Absolutely. And it goes without saying, perhaps yet, it's yet worth noting that the very discussion, the very stance we see in the text, this idea of, well, widows are a real problem. A problem for whom? A problem for this echo chamber of elite Brahmanical men who are they? They're pillars of a patriarchal system which control women, and in particular, women's sexuality. And so, I mean, you certainly make this point. I'm certain you do in the book, I think, in your introduction. But what we learn is we have much to learn from the content, but also we have much to learn from the very echo chamber of who this is for and whose voice is important and who widows are a problem for, right?
Yeah, I think you're entirely right. I think if we're talking about men, to me, the whole discussion of widows is definitely from a male's perspective. I mean, I don't know the widows were a problem for themselves or whatever, but I think we're talking about an Orthodox male Brahmin perspective. And I think the fundamental problem with widows is one of social standing and reputation. That's how I perceive it anyways. And this is where it gets more interpretive. And I'm open to alternatives, certainly, on that. But I tend to think of it as that women, the behavior of women with which you're associated, and really the perceived perception of women with which you're associated, perception being as important as fact, is a big thing to which men, these kind of men, could not be indifferent. It had a lot to do with your social standing and respectability. You even see this most famously in the Ramayana, when Rama's not a Brahmin, but Rama rejects Sita the second time. Why? Not because of her infidelity. He has no doubt that she was perfectly faithful, but because the perception of her infidelity is simply damaging to reputation. And this is something a man of his standing cannot abide. You know, though he's, you know, in love and a person of good conscience, there's something, he's kind of a luxury he could not afford. Now, he's a king, and in a special circumstance, you could say. But still, I think this was a broadly applicable idea that men could not afford to look like the women with whom they were associated were unchaste, because this was just very damaging to reputation. And so, and then, of course, it's not just chaste or unchaste, but that you can get sort of an arms race, a competitive, whose women are the more chaste? Why is that important? Because it says which men are the more respectable and upstanding. And so you can get an arms race of competitive sort of prestige hunting. The person, I'm not a big theory person at all, but the theorist that I liked on this, but the only one I really cite in the book, is Sherry Ortner has this bit on what she calls serious games. Which is, you know, that you have these kind of, changes in life and competing for position and stuff. There's rules in different societies will have different rules as to how you play the game, and that people play these. But they're serious games in the sense that they're really important outcomes. They're not a game in the sense of football or cricket or whatever. The outcome is really, really serious, but that you play them through understanding the rules of society and trying to work in your favor. And I think much of that's what's going on, that there's an attempt with women, which is why you get at some level an increase in control. Because if we accept that this is the level of control is an index of respectability, well, then if you want to look better than your neighbors, and who doesn't, you have to sort of, you know, and I think you get similar. I don't view this to me as a very foreign concept, like something at all unique to classical India or India in general. I think I see this kind of behavior all over in my own life. You know, people that, I don't know, if you're really into organic food, then how do you get to be the most organic? How do you keep the most, you know, they get as strict as, but only locally grown. And so there's a kind of competitive, to be the most upstanding by this metric, because that's the community you belong to, and that's what matters. If you belong to a community where other things matter, you compete in that way. Maybe
the primordial.
That's how I tend to view things.
Indeed. So, final question: is this work that you're continuing somehow? What's next? What now?
Oh no, I think I've said my last bit about widows. I guess, is that true? Yeah, more or less. I think I've said my piece. I'll probably end up getting asked for little things, but I think I'm done with that. My next project I want to write a history of vegetarianism. That's kind of my next broader, not a full-fledged history where I take into account everything, but at least a bit like this, where I look at vegetarianism and its incorporation within Dharma Shastra as kind of an index for Brahmins, So when did Brahmanical custom fully embrace vegetarianism? To what degree? You know, these sorts of things. So that's what that's my next kind of thematic plan. And then I've got text editing. My next thing I'm going to come out with is there's a common Dharma Shastra commentary that I'm working on. That's from at least the 9th century. It could be a little bit older. So it's very old by Dharma Shastra commentary standards. And I'm making an edition and translation of that. That's for sure the next thing. And then after that, I think a history of vegetarianism. But that's history of vegetarianism is way off in the future. But I've thought about that. I think it's a good topic.
You definitely have to send me the history of vegetarianism, whatever it comes
Yeah, out. Well, Dharma Shastra can be so boring or it can be interesting. It just depends on what aspects of the customs you're interested in, you know. So vegetarianism, to me, is a very interesting topic. I think a lot of people will find that interesting. I think treatment of widows was an interesting topic. But there's other things in Dharma Shastra that maybe even I would struggle to find that interesting. I don't know. History of teeth cleaning and stuff like that. They have talk about that too. And I don't know, etiquette and teeth cleaning just doesn't interest me. So there's areas you could go into which many people maybe would find boring, but I try to write on topics that are of a bit better interest, and then also controversial within the tradition, because then that gets a lot more interesting. What was the tradition struggling with? You know, if it's something where they all have consensus, that's kind of boring forever and ever. But the stuff where the tradition had a point where they really disagreed, that's, I think, fun. And then you see, okay, they disagree here. There's some arguments. Why'd they disagree, you know?
Well, without question, issues such as sati and which animals one can and cannot eat are not issues that are only controversial in our day and age. I mean, these are tensions within tradition.
yeah, exactly. Of course, it wouldn't matter the same, I suppose, in like a Western context when, you know, killing and eating almost anything, except for a dog or a horse, I guess, it's okay. You know, so there's not we'd have to look at other things. What are they concerned about there? But I think within the classical Indian tradition, yeah, this is for sure vegetarian. And then also vegetarianism becoming so much more popular today, I think is something that students with no personal connection to India can find interesting. That's my hope. And hopefully it'll be that in a way that's also just perfectly philologically rigorous and hopefully at the same time not too boring to kind of regular readers.
Well, listen, I mean, to my mind, that's the unicorn that we aspire after, something that's philologically rigorous or, intellectually rigorous at the very least, and also accessible and interesting to those who are beyond the 12 people in our niche, right?
Yeah, right. So that's the hope with these, with the next one. But I imagine something similar-ish to Widows Under Hindu Law. I just don't know, but for vegetarianism in terms of style and approach. But we'll see. I really have to look at it. It's really in its infancy, this project. So I've looked at a bit and think it's going to be a fun project when I get around to it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. For those listening, of course, we've been speaking with Dr. David Brick on a brand new publication, Widows. I have many windows open. Widows Under Hindu Law. Until next time, keep listening. Keep well, keep sane, keep thinking, and keep contemplating widowhood and whether or not it's a problem for anybody. Take care.